Well, today we're going to discuss convenience versus strength or robustness. And what primed this question was the building industry, because I mentioned to the A Ruminations team that basically a log is a lot stronger than a cut piece of lumber. And if you think about it, once you cut the grain, the growth rings on a tree, you enter into areas where you've broken the continuous strength of a log. However, because it's cut into lumber and boards, it's easier to manufacture large buildings and projects. So it's very convenient, even though it lost some strength in the process.
So that got me thinking about Lego. Lego bricks make it super easy to construct something, but generally it's not something that you would think of as a strong item unless you glue them together. So yes, it's very easy to make something, ease of construction, but you lose strength from it. So that's a kind of obvious example to me. And Toby, where did you go for that one?
So I went in two directions, but one of the more interesting to me currently is actually, we were talking about wood, and I started thinking about deadwood and how we talk about that in our organizations. And then I actually had this realization that this sort of convenience versus strength actually plays in a whole lot in how we think about roles and responsibilities and job descriptions. Because what I realized all of a sudden was that if people are a bit like logs, well, I could be dumb as one at times, but then the role, sort of when we have a very set job description, we do the same thing. We sort of cut against the grains and sort of we go, well, this is the bit we want. This is sort of the hardwood, because that makes construction of our massive machine easier. It's more convenient. Sort of we have planks. We can sort of use that to build our organization with. And of course, if we take a more flexible approach and sort of look at every person or every log as an sort of more individually, we can construct something that's much stronger, but it requires a different set of skills and a different way of approaching how we build it. And of course, everything becomes more bespoke and less scalable.
I really like that. I hadn't thought about job roles as shaving bits off a person's set of skills. That's actually quite insightful. What I'm thinking is we think, let's do a reorganization and let's design the perfect thing that is going to do all of the jobs that we need to get done in the company. And you know, people go into a room, generally a bunch of managers, and they go, oh, okay, this is the hierarchy we need. We need the, you know, a boss at the top, and we need some middle managers, and we need some people who are doing stuff. And then what are the silos of what they're doing? And you're exactly right. It's very easy if we go, the role is just this. And then you've got to ask people, well, which role do you want when you do the reorg?
And you're shaving off all of these other aspects. You're pruning all the branches. You're making it nice and square in order to fit that box. I think it plays into scale and convenience in two ways. One, it's much easier to think about your organization like this. You draw out all the boxes, you place all the skills in the right boxes, and then the problem is finding sort of plug compatible people into these particular roles, and whatever things they can do that isn't exactly that doesn't really matter much. You just sort of shave that off and sort of jam them into the box. And that makes it easy. It makes it easy to talk about. It makes it easy to explain, because if you have two of the same, you can just go, well, those two are fungible. They're interchangeable. Pick one out, sort of put someone else in. And you can also outsource or scale up hiring for it, because you're just sort of going on this template. And it has convenience in the replaceability. It has a lot of really attractive properties if you just disregard the human cost of the whole thing. So I can see why it's popular.
As long as we're aware that we're trading strength for that convenience, then it's not so bad, right?
Yeah, it's an understandable trade-off. And what I think is so interesting about it is one of the key questions that has sort of bubbled up on these HR engagement surveys over the past few years is the question, do you feel that all your skills are used in your current position, or do you have anything else you think you could contribute to the organization that isn't getting used? So that has become a theme both in HR and sort of in how we design more humane organizations. And of course, using the box approach, using the convenience approach, the most resounding answer you tend to get from a group is, yes, there's a lot of things I can do that isn't utilized in my current role, but it's also sort of not convenient. And you end up in that if you let people flourish, you need to sort of take a completely different route to getting what you want, getting the outcomes you sort of desire in a sense. I think that that also goes for the log cabin. I've never built a log cabin, so this is pure speculation. It's a power of metaphor, sort of talk about something you don't understand in terms of something you understand less of. But as I would envision it, if I have planks, I'll just take one from the pile and sort of I'll sort of find a few nails and I sort of jam it in and I'm building my house or shed or whatever it is. With the log cabin, I have a set of logs and to a certain extent, I'll need to take the individuality of the logs into account. I'm always searching for the bit and also the materials end up shaping the end result to a much greater degree. I end up with an emergent design. I didn't actually design that thing. I could only sort of, it's an interplay.
It'd be the same sort of thing with those stone walls, wouldn't it, Stephen?
Yeah, ones you freestand.
Yeah.
Any masonry, really, unless you get a chisel in it and start making them bricks. I mean, the funny thing about a log cabin analogy, the irony there is it's actually more convenient to use logs if you're in a forest because they're there. You cut them down, you hone them down, you know, you chip off the little rough bits. And if you really want to use every scrap of timber, you actually top and tail them. So the wider part of the log is near the skinnier part of the log of the other tree. Mm. So they work out basically the same height when you add the two together. So you can actually top and tail them. I haven't seen that in a log cabin design. They tend to be very consistent in log shape because most log cabins are built from very tall trees. So you can get quite a few logs of a similar diameter out of one tree. However, it's sort of funny that you thought it was the timber, because if you think about it, you have to send it to some place or saw it to planks or lumber, squared off lumber. That's a lot of work away from where you've got the forest. So it's sort of ironic that the lumber is considered easier for us who have trucks and machines and sawmills. But from a pioneering point of view, a roughly honed bit of log is way easier than milling lumber.
Well, you just made me think. You know, when we talk about hiring people, sometimes you're looking for the skill and the certification, right? And a lot of the time people say, look, I'd rather hire someone who's got the will, someone who's willing and eager to learn and all that sort of thing, than someone who might not be as eager to learn but has all these certifications and bits of paper. So I was just thinking what you just said there, Stephen, with the taking the logs away to turn them into planks and bits of lumber is a little bit like taking your staff out to go do a couple of days or a couple of weeks of training, right? So there's quite a lot of effort to give people skills so that they get the certification bit of paper. And sometimes that's perfectly valid, but I think sometimes it is like effort that you didn't really need to spend.
You've also got to remember there's waste when you mill.
Mm.
Like even a lot of people, when they cut timber and they're trying to build something, they actually forget that when you cut it with a saw blade, you lose like 2 to 3 millimeters of material when you cut it. So you've got to cut on the outside of your mark, not on your mark, because things won't line up, right? So, I mean, even it's obvious and it's simple if you know what you're doing or you've done it before and you've been caught out, but it's like, why is this timber slightly shorter? But the same happens with logs. Like when you start milling them, there's a lot of wastage. So it's sort of, when you grow plants, like a tomato will just sprout up in your garden, or a little tree will start sprouting. If you leave it where it is, it'll grow really well.
Mm.
I have a large tree in the front yard, testimony to that. But if you move it, it often suffers a setback. It actually can even die from the trauma of being transplanted. So when you're training people, there is also a lot of waste, because their natural aptitudes don't necessarily get focused in the training. The training tends to be a way of, this is the way we do it, and that's wasteful, but not many people look at it that way. It's like it's easy to get the Lego block and build a house or a building from the Lego, rather than let's work with try and build a fence without bricks, like a masonry wall without them cut to size. It's a lot harder. You've got to go rummaging through the rubble to find the blocks of rock that are appropriate for the bit you're making. It takes a long time to build a freestyle wall like that.
Mm.
So this is, I'm getting so many ideas all at once. I don't really know where to go from here, but I'll just take one of the threads. Because what I'm hearing in this also sort of has a deep parallel into the right shifting model, And sort of you could probably put this on our worldly map too, but you have sort of this organizational effectiveness scale. Sort of we go through different phases, and sort of the log cabin or sort of stone cabin built in place where I'm at, that's ad hoc organization. We tend to, in a startup or in Genesis, I would suppose, we work with what we have and the ideas, and we go with it. Sort of we use the logs that we have, and we build something that often ends up being both artisanal and sort of has all of these nuances and compromises in it. And as we try to scale it, so as we become more mature as an organization, we end up in this, where most organizations are today, in this mechanistic, analytical, we've defined the boxes, we know what planks we need in order to stamp these things out, and we're collecting raw materials in one end, we're milling them, and we're putting them into this thing, and we're using this machine metaphor, and we're scaling up. And then we get all of this sort of milling and force fitting, which seems like that's where most organizations are, and that's sort of where you tend to end up at scale due to convenience and due to, in a sense, a feeling that you can afford the wastage, sort of, because you don't know how to coordinate all of these tiny startup things. And then we see sort of the current edge of contemporary organizations, the synergistic ones, the ones that are trying to actually be agile, the networked organizations, where you're with discipline going back to exploiting what's close to you, and you're trying to do that at structured scale and in collaboration with others, but you're not getting determined results, you're not sort of designing the outcomes, you're tending towards, you're creating emergent outcomes, and then you have both scale and strength. And it's you have coherence, but it's also in the small bespoke in a way. Does that make sense?
Hmm. Yeah. I think it's interesting that if you want to move forward, like even if you're just, freewheeling a log cabin with logs or trying to make a rock wall from whatever rocks you found on your paddock or whatever, and you want to make a temporary rock wall out of it or permanent, they last a long time if you do them right and have a good capstone, need a capstone. But basically what's interesting is that you need to have a sense of reflection and renaissance over it. So when you build it, a lot of the things that are built like that get revisited over time and patched and modified. And the thing about wastage that I find is interesting in the, I'll use the term, cookie cutter way of doing stuff that we do in the Western world, right? It's all assembly line. Is that the wastage is actually what, we don't actually see the wastage, we don't realize it. And it's very sad because what we're losing is skills and craftsmanship and the ability to see, IKEA, right? Land of IKEA, you're from the land of IKEA, right? That is basically, it's prefabbed in a way that you, with an Allen key, a special little tool, you can make it. I could also say, well, my version of IKEA would be go to the local hardware shop, buy a few pre-cut boards and a few screws, and there you go. But then you don't know how to put them together. You've lost that ability. IKEA actually shows you which bits to put together, right? So you see how the skill and the craftsmanship gets sort of sucked away without you noticing in the IKEA model? Like, and mind you, a lot of people can't even follow the instructions, so that's not a helpful thing. But that ability to look and see how things are put together, we've been losing over decades because we don't look at the raw materials. We look at a prefabricated box.
Hmm. And I think that there's such an interesting tension in this that I've built more IKEA furniture than I care to admit. And I've also done all the sort of mistakes with cutting and sort of cutting inside the line and instead of outside of it and wondering why the heck it doesn't fit. I'm a horrible craftsman when it comes to woodworking. But you have this tension that I get the freedom from just buying the flat pack and sort of putting it together. That sort of lets a lot of people scale the idea of furniture, which is an achievement in terms of improved living conditions and sort of flexibility for us and convenience, massively convenient because we don't need the strength and the more traditional things. But as you say, it also if we overly focus on that, or if that's the only thing we see, we forget the craftsmanship that goes into the other thing, and we forget the skills, and we sort of, we hollow out our communal understanding of how things work, and we actually, we lose the expertise. And when that happens, this also seems like an apt scaling metaphor. When we do it too much, if it would be farming, we end up with a monoculture. And that sort of, that can have massive gains in the midterm, but it tends towards catastrophic collapse in the long term, due to, if you have a monoculture, then, well, a single disease or a single problem can actually, will hit the population equally.
Do you think it's time restraint? I'm just toying with the idea. I think we're in such a hurry. I've never understood. Life expectancy is longer than ever before and all the rest of it. We seem to rush around so much that we put all this pressure on us, on our very selves, that we need to do it now. I'm highly guilty of this myself. Like I tend to try to do everything in 5 minutes if I can, right? So I'm thinking it's a time restraint which we put on ourselves because our culture is like more. Got to do more, got to do it better, got to do it faster. But we don't actually understand. The metric we use for better, faster, more is just quantity. And we all know bulk, quantity doesn't equal quality. And I'm sort of sad because I see a lot of people don't understand how things work. That really demoralizes me. Like to be able to look at something and understand how it works is a great gift. And I don't bump into people that can do that very often.
It's like the difference between when you have to design your team and when you get lumped with a group of people. So sometimes you sort of walk in and you've just I've had times in my career where I've just ended up with a group of people ended up being part of my team in a somewhat random fashion, and we ended up shaping what we were doing based on the people's skills who are in the team and the needs that seemed to be coming from outside of the team. So it's sort of shaped itself into it, but it took time. It wasn't something that I could do as a part of a workforce plan. It just had to emerge as we learnt and as we went. Whereas, you know, a lot of people have an expectation, well, you can't even start to put a team together until you've done your workforce planning activity. So I don't know that it's just a time thing. So I started off that little comment with, yes, I was agreeing with you. I think it is also a time factor, but I think it's also an expectation of certainty. So sometimes it's a let's do it fast, and sometimes it's a make sure it's right before you start.
Okay, but what you've done, what you've done is you basically, the team lumped together all hodgepodge of all random people and abilities. That's the log cabin looking at the rock and working out where it goes in the wall, right?
Yep.
That's that mentality, adaptability. Being able to think on your feet, being able to manage. That's the sign of a good manager or leader, right? You work to you look at what strengths you have, you focus on them and build them, and you get them to help the people with those points are their weakness. You get them to strengthen the other people, and their strengths help buffer the whole group, right? So each one that has strengths also has weaknesses, and hopefully there's enough people that you can sort of carry everyone up. Lift all the boats by raising the water, right? The tide comes in, everyone goes up. But the other one is, and this is the irony, when you handpick your team, we tend to look on paper for the best.
Yes.
The best don't work well together. You can't have 15 captains in a group because they all think they know the right answer. And the irony is, it's possible they all have the right answer, but they can't work together. Or you can't change the horse in mid-race. So if one person starts going down one path of this is what we've got to do, and then someone else sort of usurps, you know, power in the group and says, no, we've got to go this way, it's like a zigzagging line all over the place. There's no direction and there's no chance of you getting to where you want to go. So I think that's my problem with the prefab stuff is we don't realise when we cut logs off, we weaken the structure. Very few people realise a log is stronger than the same, you know, the bit of lumber cut from it. Like, and I'm talking like 2 to 3 or even 4 times stronger. So it's a huge
And I think that's what happens in organizations too. We don't realize that by constraining people as we do, we also lose a lot of strength. We lose engagement. We lose innovation. We lose ideas. We lose diversity. We lose all of these things. But we do it partially, I think, just to tie back to what you said earlier. We were living in a culture of acceleration. Everything, we keep repeating this mantra that things are moving faster than ever before. So we end up in this infinite hustle. It's sort of everyone is just sort of trying to get ahead and trying to sort of do more things faster. And we become less reflective. And also, as we hollow out the expertise and understanding of things, we're actually also getting more inefficient in many ways, because we don't have time to build understanding. We don't have time to do all of these things that we keep talking about, like actually understanding the problem before trying to solve it. We're actually just doing things in a hurry. And in team composition terms, I've seen this so many times. So my preferred model is the one you were talking about, Kim. The sort of, we have a group of people, they have a set of skills, we have a set of problems, let's try to figure out how to sort of have everyone flourish and have that sort of coincide with something that's useful. And then we can adjust plans and sort of do compromises as we go along. So that's my very strongly preferred role or mode of working. And then we have sort of another sort of way I've seen successful, and that's to sort of figure out what the problem is, ensure that we have the right skills and sort of the right people. And the right people aren't just sort of, I hired all the A-stars. It's actually sort of, we have complementary skills and personalities in order to actually bring this forth. But that takes a lot of time and care to set the team up. And then we have what most companies do. And that seems to be, I have a project that is strictly defined. And then I have people on the bench. So just take the random people on the bench and shove them into the project and get it started this week, because this week is the best week. You can't wait until next week when the right people are available. So you get and that usually tends towards not producing the wanted outcomes. At least that's my experience. But it's very, very common.
And it is convenient.
It's very, very convenient, because it ends up being a spreadsheet exercise. Mm. It's a resourcing problem, as they say. You just look at sort of who's available, well, these, and sort of, do they tick all the boxes? Yep, they do. Then we have a team. Go.
Mm. There's a couple of things I've just been thinking about. And one is, we all put it on ourselves, right? We're all in a rush to get somewhere. God knows why we're in a rush, because the final destination is death. So I'm not in a hurry. I'll sort of take my time. But what is interesting is, like, even if you look at we make planks, a lot of people don't realize you've got to look at the growth lines, the way that the growth line on a board is. So if you want it facing up, you've got to have the arch doming up so it carries more weight. Like, even subtle things like that are being lost. Right? If you turn it the other way around, it'll bow quite significantly. So that's interesting. And the other one was basically, you know, we do all this pre-manufactured putting into boxes. I was going to say control, but it's not control. It's a feeling that we have control. Mm. It makes us feel like we're in control. If we make it a cookie cutter, or we make it into we square off the lumber. We feel more empowered and in control of the environment. So that's interesting, because if you look at people in jobs, if you say this person is qualified to do this, they've gone through the process of being trimmed to shape. We'll use the timber analogy, like they've cut into shape and formed, and they fit into the little pockets and slots that you need them to go into neatly. And the manager feels in control, the company feels in control, but they've actually taken away the control of the individual to be responsible for their own abilities and their actions. And I find that sad. It's sort of like, I know you have to have it in a business, because if people don't have a sense of responsibility and self-control, then things can go to chaos very quickly. But the problem is, if you don't enable them to have that, they don't develop that. It's the chicken and the egg argument. Like, the more we make it that you can go to IKEA and build a piece of furniture, the less you have people that can go, okay, we got 3 boxes of IKEA furniture. I can modify this one and put them together and make something else. Right?
Yeah. So I think that... on the cutting of people to shape, and sort of, I think that there's a set of reinforcing feedback loops, and there's a way of finding some rationality in the behaviors that looks supremely strange to us in this conversation. Because I think that, as you're saying, the company and sort of management to some extent, when they use strict role descriptions, they cut a lot off for convenience and they start feeling in control. And that's completely rational in a situation where you have high staff turnover, for example. then sort of standardizing it and sort of opting for convenience of recruitment and onboarding and sort of standardizing that is a survival strategy, because you can't actually afford to reconfigure the complete operation if people are leaving at a very high pace. So if you fail to sort of solve for retention, you must solve for standardization. The other end of the spectrum is if you have generally long retention, sort of if people actually stay with the company, you can give them way more freedom and can be way more flexible. And of course, the real kicker here is that what is it that tends to sort of drive retention? Well, freedom, autonomy.
I was going to interject that point that basically if you have total control over the job thing, the reason you have high turnover, which is your rationale for having the very strict, tight definitions, is the fact that people don't feel comfortable or empowered in the role. So therefore, they fill in their time, punch their time clock and run away as quick as they can because they don't feel rewarded from the experience.
It's self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that it's self-perpetuating in a way that sort of it seems to make sense that if you have a constant churn of people, then you must standardize it to make it easier to fill it. But the more you do that, that will also drive the churn that you're wanting to get rid of. And if you go in the other way, then you sort of take on a bigger burden and you take on a bigger felt risk. But on the other hand, conversely, you're actually creating a more meaningful job and a more meaningful experience and existence for the people, which actually tends to lead to them staying. So you're actually, by embracing the risk, you're actually combating it in a sense. But you sort of see these two actually, I think they're working at the same time. And I think that when you want to drastically scale, you tend to sort of, you cut your own legs off in a sense.
There's another little bit of a spanner I'm going to throw into this is, if you look at the military and how you start off as a grunt, like a low-level sort of recruit, you don't have any freedom or responsibilities. You are indoctrinated. You are forced to follow the process. And that derives self-discipline, right? The weird thing is authority leads to discipline. And then the discipline leads to the relaxing of authority. Right? People don't understand that. They think authority is bad. Authority is not bad. It's actually enabling, because the only real authority is self-authority and self-discipline, because all cultures fall apart without responsibility, self-discipline, and self-reflection on, was that really a good thing? Maybe I shouldn't have said that to that person because they probably weren't ready to hear that sort of thing that way. You know, what you said might have been 100% factual, but it wasn't truthful. Okay, there's a difference. So you can give feedback in a nice way, in a completely mean and nasty and degrading way, or in a very, not even nice, harsh but fair and with an empathy for the person's best interests. There's a lot of different ways you can feed back the same information, and people don't quite understand that. They just think, you know, I'm a boss, I'm in a position of power, and therefore, you know, you do what I say. That's fine. But there's also that if you don't let the kid grow up and experience things, they'll never be adults. I'll be a 40-year-old baby, you know, like, what do you do?
And that is trading convenience for strength, right? So it's convenient to keep someone, you know, bubble wrapped. But
and also to keep them in fear.
Yeah, but it doesn't make them strong.
The negative side of authority is it's easy to intimidate people to do the right thing, which you think is the right thing. But you actually don't have the person's best interests at heart, which is really sad. That's why parenting is like a very hard gig, because you've got to pull them back, let them sort of have accidents, as long as they're not lethal, right? Let them experience the world, and then also be able to let them go, you know, and give them the sense that you've got their back. And that is also a manager. That's a manager, a boss, a friend, a partner. That's how it works. It's a relationship, right?
And I think that this is what's beautiful about this is that it highlights how compensating for one dysfunction doesn't actually necessarily lead to something better. Because as you say, sort of authority and fear, that's one way to sort of get things done in a sense. But that's, it leads to stunted growth in a sense. And then we have the bubble wrapping that also over time actually doesn't let whatever we bubble wrap experience things that it's required for it to grow. It's like a sheltered plant. If it's never exposed to the elements, it will never grow strong and healthy. It needs sort of that outside stimulus. And what I think is interesting about that is that as a community, I think we're going through these different phases where, for me at least, where Agile started was to go sort of command and control is bad. And I think it's still sort of not great. And sort of because we come from sort of the assumption that traditional hierarchy is based on fear. So we need to abolish fear. And now we've been running under the system for a very, very long time that we sort of inject scrum masters and coaches and leaders, where sort of when you have the dysfunction of fear, which sort of you put in a scrum master similar to sort of create a bubble for the team. But if you do that sort of for too long, you end up bubble wrapping them. So you need to sort of let reality get in. So at some point you need to open the door up again. You need to create closure for them in order to grow their skills, but then you need to expose them to the outside world in order for them to progress even further and become sort of well-rounded at what they do. So I think that we're tending towards overprotection in a sense. And how do we balance these things? Because the convenient thing is either sort of going by fear or going by complete bubble wrapping and sort of removing all conflicts. And I think that's where we're at today also, sort of in the intra-team and inter-team space when we start talking about psychological safety. It's really easy to sort of make the wrong assumption that that's about comfort. And it's not. It's totally not about everyone being comfortable all the time. It's sort of, I think Amy Edmondson is very, very clear on that. It's not about comfort, but that's how it often is seen. So that's another, we're taking convenience instead of strength. We're taking away the thing that builds resilience and strength.
I'm going to nudge back. You notice I didn't say push back. I said nudge. Gentle. All right. I'm going to nudge back on a couple of things. One, fear is not bad. Fear is a survival instinct. Awareness of fear is essential to any being, any animal, any organism. It is absolutely essential. So therefore, getting rid of it is not a good move. However, to be scared and fearful is not good. To have a sense of fear is heightened awareness and focus. That's what fear does. It's meant to heighten your awareness, focus, make you look at the options, evaluate the situation. That is the reason we have fear. Fear is not a bad thing in itself. The command and control thing that you mentioned, I find interesting because you said it's not a really good thing. You know, it has a negative connotation, command and control. The irony with command and control, also with authority, is that it's only perceived as bad if you don't understand or you don't agree with what it's saying. If you agree with it, it doesn't feel like command and control. It just feels like, yeah, that's logical. You know,
yeah. Then it feels like clarity, and I think there's a lot of interesting frames in this, and I think that yes, fear is. I think fear is such a useful signal that it's really sad when it's used as the primary management tactic. When I use that instead of building strong arguments and instead of building understanding, I use fear in order to keep people in line. Then we're burning our fear budget.
Right. I will suggest don't use fear, use intimidation. Because intimidation has that evil intent.
Yeah.
I come from biology, so my side of, you know, fight or flight, you know, like, it's essential. Fear is so... Like,
I'll 100% give you that. Sort of, when we sort of do management by intimidation, we cause unnecessary fear. And fear is a mind killer in that it doesn't make you sort of think more creatively. It creates a heightened awareness, and it creates a stress that is, on occasion, really useful, because if there's a real threat out there, you do want that.
But it's unsustainable. You can't flood your brain with endorphins, panic, right? Fear, constantly. Yes, you can drink coffee and you can sort of, you know, have all those energy drinks and all the rest of it. But eventually, it is so detrimental to your psyche and the way you behave that any advantages you gain in the short term or even middle term are completely eroded by the costs long term.
And as a leader, if you lead by intimidation, you'll very, very quickly realize that anytime you're not there, that leadership isn't really happening. It's not leadership. It's just sort of people are going along with it. It's coercion, and it's based on intimidation. It's not sustainable in the long term, as you say. It's the same mechanism, and it will burn you out.
The funny thing about authoritarian or the intimidation thing, you don't feel safe unless you feel like you're protected or you're allowed to make mistakes and someone's got your back. So the authoritarian thing is quite interesting and complex in a management thing, because if your manager's wussy and la-la touchy-feely, and most people will walk all over them, no matter how good the intentions are. But if you are firm, there's an old saying in teaching, never smile before Easter. And, and it works. It's true. Never be king of the kids in the beginning of the year. But if you start as from an authoritarian stance in the beginning, and then you can loosen off and become more mellow by the time you get to Easter, the kids, you have that authoritarian persona to go back to. You understand that? So as a teacher, you can always go back to the authoritarian version of yourself that you were in the beginning of the year and still be fairly friendly with the kids and allow latitude. But you need to have that authoritarian stance. If you start off as king of the kids in the beginning, it takes you so much more draconian measures to get the authoritarian across later on in the year that you become not a very nice person doing that, going that way. It's easier to loosen off than to tighten up after being loose.
So similar to talking about trust, blind trust is generally not a great thing. What we want to do when we're asking people to trust us is provide proof. So trust with proof points to me is a very valid thing. So I think it's not quite the same concept of what you're talking about, but it's a similar and related concept. Yeah, you need to have that feedback mechanism to make it a comfortable concept.
Well, I think that's the idea of professionalism. If you're professional, that's why I don't have a problem working with the biggest asshole. I don't care who you are, how obnoxious you are. If you do your work and you show some courtesy and willingness to sort of like, you know, back off, okay, unneeded, it's workable. That's why consistency and professionalism is very important when I'm sort of doing stuff. You have to be consistent and you have to be professional, because those two go hand in hand. It's a marriage. People know where they stand. People can work around you. People can understand what your intentions are. That's integral in teaching and management. It's very interesting that people don't quite understand that. They get caught up in, oh, he hurt my feelings, or it's like, okay, well, maybe it was tactless to say it that way. But you have to be able to harden up and understand the intent. That's why I don't like PC, HR stuff. I find that offensive, all of that stuff. It's mollycoddling to people wrapped in cotton wool. And if you wrap someone in bubble wrap, they suffocate. So that's not very good.
I think that there's this need and desire we have for certainty actually is at play here too. Because I often said that consistency is sort of, if you're consistent pain in the butt, people can still appreciate you in a sense because they know what to expect. But if you're seemingly erratic or random, then you have a much, much harder time, even if you occasionally do brilliant things. It's sort of because people need to be able to know what to expect. And the more uncertainty there's in the world or in the environment, the more we tend towards wanting something to anchor with. And that's sort of, I think that why we value dependability in relationships so much is that sort of we know that they will always come through. It's a sense of consistency. We know that that person will always be there, or sort of they always got my back. And that makes us sort of secure to try other things. And I think that's actually the core quality we need to scale trust, in a sense, is that consistent meeting of expectations. And one thing on that, as I tend to say to the teams I work with in different ways, is that if you have a trust issue with a stakeholder or anything like that, the main way you need to sort of, the way you mend that is not by saying, trust us, we're professional, because they'll just go, why? And it just usually doesn't go anywhere. The way you build trust is via consistency. Consistently meet your targets, consistently sort of deliver something until they get tired of it. And that's when sort of a lot of people try to gain trust by running faster, delivering more. But in so doing, they become less consistent.
Yeah. When I did a small stint with IBM GSA, one of the CEO was basically, you know, those stupid team things where they get everyone together in a hall. Total waste of time. Anyway, someone just put up, you know, he came out and said, oh, how do we build trust? And to me, that was like, well, that's a simple bloody answer. And no one seemed to. So me being me, I put up my hand and I said, well, it's easy. make three promises and keep them. That's it. It doesn't have to be, I promise everyone, you know, has a huge pay rise. It can be, yep, I'll turn up on time. When you make a meeting, you make a promise that you'll be there at that time. It's as simple as that. If you turn up on time, they trust you. They know that the next meeting you make, right? It doesn't have to be huge, but you have to keep the three promises. And then once you show you're trustworthy in those sort of things, like, okay, if you work late tonight, you can have a day off. How many, or time in lieu. I always used to joke that time in lieu meant in the toilet. But yeah, you never get it. I said to people, you know, whatever you do, make sure you get that time in lieu back, because otherwise it's flushed, it's gone, it's down the toilet. Because managing, when's a convenient time for you to take a week off?
Well, that's the other name for a loo, is a convenience.
It just doesn't work that way. It just, like, every time someone says, oh, I'll get time in lieu, it's like, make sure you don't have more than 2 or 3 days, because once it gets to a week, it's never convenient for anybody to give you that much time off. It's a fallacy, and that's the trust thing. Like, if you're going to offer time in lieu, you have to make sure that people take it. And even if they don't take it directly in that week or month, you allocate that time a month and a half down the track. Okay, there's your time in lieu on that date. So I always thought it was funny that no one really worked out how do we get trust back, and it's like, make three promises and keep them.
Mm.
Simple. But apparently no one in the group thought of that. So anyway, it seemed obvious to me. I don't know. So anyway, consistency and trust. So
we started with trading strength for convenience, and we ended up with consistency and trust. That's pretty cool.
Love that.
Well, consistency and trust, you could say, is pre-milled lumber.
Because it's consistent.
It's consistent, and if it's kiln-dried, it has a certain humidity content, so therefore you can trust that it's going to bear that much load.
Mm.
Logs have hidden surprises, put it that way. Splits and cracks, and so there is an advantage to mill it down, but it is wasteful. Right? It just depends which side of the coin you want, or sphere you want to look at. I'll say sphere, because they have one side or no sides, depending on your point of view.
Which side of the log?
But I just find it funny. Like, that's why I mentioned it, because it's very unknown that very, very few people realise that a log is stronger than any lumber you can cut out of it, and significantly stronger.
And I love how it sort of ties it all together, that it is stronger. It might be more sort of, it has that, but it also has hidden surprises, and you need to sort of make yourself comfortable with that, and you need to sort of be deliberate and sort of choose that. I think that's so wonderful, because it says so much about all the things we've been talking about. Is you have these trade-offs, you need to be conscious about them, and you can get something that's stronger, but it will also mean that you'll have to live with the hidden surprises.
Yeah, I mean, the beautiful thing about a log is if you cut a tree down and you make a long log, and you think, okay, well, that size should be strong enough to carry that much weight, and you start putting weight on it, it'll crack at the weakest point. So then you'll end up with two very strong logs that used to be one very long one with a weak spot. You see how it works? So if you're working organically like that, the fact that it fell down or broke under weight, under stress, is not a negative. You actually found out where its weak spot was. So now you know it's gone. Like, it's literally gone. Now it's the end of another log. So it's gone, right? So there you go. Like, it's that ability to look at that and not think, oh, my log is broken and it was inadequate. It's like, well, okay, it's not adequate for that span, but now it's really strong for the shorter span.
So essentially, finding weak spots by exposing it to pressure, and then go celebrating that we now have two stronger subsystems. It's probably possible to make an architecture talk out of this.
Well, to me, that's the organic way of building stuff. Kim finds it quite funny, like, I can build stuff out of whatever I've got lying around. And I don't see it as a problem, like, because I just see how things go together. I don't know, that's just, I've always been able to do it. But that is, I'm not going to put myself on the same plane as Leonardo, but that's the Renaissance, that you have a generalist attitude, which is why I talked about experts and dodos and a cautionary tale. But you have that attitude where if you focus on one thing, specifically on one thing, by denying all the other branches of science or art or philosophy, you diminish the one thing you learn. You might know that really well, but you don't see where it fits in and how it can how it can help and bolster the other areas. So literally, I did a lot of science for a very long time, and I had to take 2 weeks off to draw. I was going nuts. And then I realized my art side, my artsy-fartsy side of me wasn't getting any oxygen. It was all science for like 12 years or something. So I had to start drawing and painting. And then I was okay. And then I went back to the science. So, but you need that ability to see different areas, because when you see where things fit in, you understand if that's a really good fit and it will function well in the environment. Because working in a vacuum is easy. Like if you have everything, it's an echo chamber, you know. If it's isolated and you test it and it's in isolation, that's fine. That's the difference between you guys coding and then you put it in production and you find out, whoops, it shouldn't be looking at that, or, oh, that fell over. That's the difference between a testing platform and then in production.
Yeah, well, so I was thinking about that, and maybe you have some input on this, Kim, because you usually tend to talk at people at a bigger scale and higher level than I do. But I was thinking about the log analogy and sort of how this relates to when we have a slightly larger scale architecture. Let's call it an enterprise architecture. In one case, we've made up our mind that sort of this is the log we have. It's this length. It's sort of, it should carry this load. That's sort of the big upfront design in a sense. And as Stephen said, once we put the load on it, we might actually find a fracture plane that we didn't put into design, but that was sort of became visible once we pressure tested it. Sort of it snapped in two. And now we have two options. Either we sort of go with the new design. We found a natural fracture point so we can sort of create two strong resilient systems, and we have sort of, well, this is where it tends to break, so we can do something about that breakage point. Or we try to amend the design or amend the log, in a sense, find a better log to carry the load. And one of them is, of course, making up our minds beforehand and then sort of executing on the plan. And the other one is a more iterative emergent design. But how would you phrase that to a high-level architecture group? And sort of how would you make people understand that this is actually a sensible way to sort of get the weaknesses out by just pressure testing it and then sort of designing around where it broke?
So I see things break when we've got off-the-shelf packages. So my brain went a slightly different path with that question. And what I've seen happen is we go, oh, okay, we think we need all of these features and functions, so let's buy this thing off the shelf that does at least 80% of that stuff. Fabulous. And then when you actually go to implement it, that's when you find those problems. So that is exactly like stepping on that log. And I've been in situations where people have said, oh, we need it to do all of these things. And you suddenly found out that there was one major thing that it just can't do. And if you wanted to implement that into that system, you're going to double the cost. And we're not talking about small amounts of money here. So that was quite tricky. But at least we found it before we tried to implement it, because that meant that we could actually separate that thing out and find the right system for it to sit in. So my experience has been slightly different to what you're talking about, Toby, but I've seen it in off-the-shelf software where you can make good decisions about splitting functionality out, and it's not necessarily before you go and buy the off-the-shelf software. Yeah, so I think that's a similar example.
Yeah, I like that example. I like that idea of sort of, because I think that's a, to me, that sounds like an implementation of what I'm sort of trying to find here. That sort of, you have the off-the-shelf system, you think it will be able to do all the things, you're smart enough to test it before going live, and you sort of go, oops, couldn't do that, it broke in this particular spot. And this sounds like a perfect sort of, okay, but we needed to do that thing, but we don't need this thing to do that thing. Now that we know that we have this weakness in it, we can solve for that separately, and we have these two, we have a better understanding of the two disjoint parts of the log too. So we've split the domain in our understanding, and we've also sort of figured out where sort of here's where we either need to sort of go get the thing to do that thing, and that might be very, very expensive, or get another thing to carry that particular part of the load, and that's okay. Mm. And we sort of found that by doing that. I think that's a wonderful example.
Mm. I do like that idea of thinking about the exercise that we did, like jumping on it. I would have liked to jump on that system a few times. the one that I'm actually thinking of.
But I think the idea, we don't embrace failure very well, because we think of failure as failure, but failure is the path to learning. If you don't load the log and then it breaks it at its weakest point, a lot of people would say, oh, well, that failed the test. Yeah, it did fail the test, but it also provided two very useful shorter lengths that have been very strong and will go to the test point. So it's sort of interesting that we have an inherent aversion to failing. I think that comes from the fear and dying sort of thing from evolution, right? If you fail, you're dead. But when you're exploring things, the irony is if you have to really work at it, it's so rewarding when it comes through and it's right. Like you feel such a sense of accomplishment when it works. You turn the key, it starts. You flick the switch, something happens. It's a very creative and very rewarding thing. And I don't know whether in the modern Western way of doing things, we tend to actually appreciate that. Like, as we are failure adverse, we also seem to strip away the sense of accomplishment because we just follow a recipe. And I find that a little sad. Like, people find it funny that I can cook stuff with basically nothing. And it's sort of like, it's not cooking. It's just, you know, it's chemistry. It's like, well, okay, that we'll put that with that and that with that. Done, right? It's just the way it is. A lot of people need to follow a recipe. And I don't have a problem with people following a recipe. Do it once, do it twice. But also be aware that you can change certain ingredients and get away with it. Sometimes it's a disaster. It happens, right? But you learn from it. So I think that's an interesting thing with our culture at the moment. We're so scared of failure that we tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater and don't let people sort of experience the sense of accomplishment that comes through failure.
Mm. Yeah, so accomplishment sort of requires us to overcome, in a sense.
Well, it increases the reward factor, that's for sure.
Yeah. So sort of, if there's no challenge, there's usually no sense of achievement either, really.
I mean, you're talking to someone who ridiculously will go spend a couple hundred bucks to buy a broken guitar. Literally. Why? Because I like fixing them. Yeah, it's stupid. Why? Kim's not overly happy, by the way. They take up room. But, you know, broken necks, broken headstocks, the necks ripped off the bodies of the guitar. And the idea is I want to repair them, not so they're, you can't see them, because I don't believe in deception, but I want to repair them so when you put your hand over the brakes, you don't feel it. And the trick, if you're trying to repair it like that, you have to close your eyes. Because I'll tell you now, if you're looking at it, you'll think you feel it.
Mm.
Your eyes actually tell you feel it, even when it's not there. It's funny. It's really weird. So if you're trying to repair something so it's visible but not felt, you have to close your eyes while you're doing it, when you're running your hand to see if it's fixed properly.
So that does bring us back to the original topic, because we were talking about trading strength for convenience. So if we go with the convenient way to get things done all the time, then we don't have the risk of failure. We don't have the sense of achievement when we overcome, and we don't build up the strength to do those sorts of things better in the future.
And strength of character, robustness, which is strength of, you know, adaptability and survival. There's a whole bunch of things we sacrifice unknowingly by the convenience. And I don't know, I've always been white. Give me 10 options, I'll always pick the hardest one. It's a character flaw. I can't help it. Just I'll always pick the one that's harder to do. I might swear a lot, but I'll get there eventually, possibly. But, you know, it's a challenge. I like doing things like that. No, don't worry. That's not why I married you.
That's good to hear.
I'm lying. She's a challenge.
Oh, that could be the best ending yet.
That's all right. I can cut it out later.
Oh, that's wonderful.
See, it's not what you say. It's your intent and your motive behind it.
So do we think we're done with that one? We can stop recording?
We can be done with that. I think Toby's gone off enough tangents. Okay.
I can't stop the last
All right, Toby,
of that anyway.
We'll kill it now. See you, man.